The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
We have a very special guest with us tonight, as you can see. Charles Yu is the author of four books, including Interior Chinatown, which was the winner of the 2020 National Book Award for Fiction, and the novel How to Live Safely in a Science Fictional Universe, which was a New York Times notable book and Time Magazine Best Book of the Year. Charlie received the National Book Foundation's 5 Under 35 Award and was nominated for 2 Writers Guild of America Awards for his work on the HBO series Westworld. He has also written for shows on FX, AMC, and others on HBO. His fiction and nonfiction have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and Wired, along with other publications. Together with TaiwaneseAmerican.org, he established the Betty L. Yu and Jin C. Yu Creative Writing Prizes in honor of his parents. Luckily for us, Charlie is joining us virtually tonight for a conversation about the spectacular novel I know many of you have already read or will be reading very soon, Interior Chinatown. Without further delay, you're going to watch me talk to Charlie on Zoom. Okay, so I've read this book like several times, so we're going to get in the weeds. You have a chance to ask questions, but you know, this is mine. Charlie, my favorite character is Phoebe. Could you talk a bit about, I'll say this, I think it was through reading about Phoebe, who is the daughter of the main character. It was through reading about Phoebe that I realized that this book, I started talking about this book as being about freedom. It feels at times when I, you know, she's my favorite. So it feels like it builds toward the question at the end for me, which is, what is Phoebe's life going to be like? Could you talk about writing Phoebe, why she's important to you as a character?
Yes, I love that she's your favorite. I think, you know, not to play favorites myself, but I think she was probably my favorite character to write, you know, write in the book and write in her voice. I think implied in your question is kind of the answer already, which was that she represents a future that's different than what her parents and grandparents and, you know, ancestors, I guess, could have imagined. At least that's how it seems like her reality is so different from Willis's. Willis's is trapped in this very reductive role, and he's internalized all of these limitations on what he can be or what he thinks he can be. And Phoebe is really the opposite. She's, you know, she has a name. She's not generic Asian kid or anything like that. She's just this imaginative, curious kid. And, you know, I have 2 kids of my own and drew a lot of inspiration from late night conversation, or not so late night, but right before their bedtime, you know, which is for any parents out there, probably know that's like peak exhaustion, you know, 6:30, 7 p.m. with a toddler. It can be, you know, for me anyway, conversations with my kids around that time of day were often me lying on the floor, eyes closed, like just trying to limp to the finish line. But also then there'd be moments of like, you know, just unexpected fun or giggling, or sometimes just something surprising, you know, something really heartwarming or heartbreaking would come out of their mouths. So some of my favorite conversations, so I just stole from my kids basically, and I put it in the book.
It probably happens a lot. I listened to a podcast actually where you were talking about Willis and how important it is that Willis is somebody's son and how clear that is in the text. And again, thinking of Phoebe, if Willis is a son, he's a son who is a father. And so I think about, with that, I think about how, you know, we see in this book, Willis figuring it out. And it's not that he has it figured out when Phoebe arrives. So yeah, I guess I wonder how you think about the stuff that Willis is going through and what it takes for Phoebe to have a certain kind of life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense, I think. And tell me if what I'm saying goes off track of what I think you're talking about. But when you say what it takes, to me, that sort of implies a lot. And the main thing it implies is that you can't get there in one generation, that assimilation, whatever that means, or just the process of immigration and a family like Willis's, where his parents were immigrants, Willis grew up here, wherever here is in our kind of fantasy world, and then Phoebe is the generation after. And so Willis is kind of in the middle, you know, as you're talking about, he's both a son and a father, and he gets to basically bridge that, right? I mean, between the generation of Willis's parents and Willis is this incredible gap that I experienced myself, because I was a first generation American in the sense that I was born in the US. My parents came when they were pretty young, and they, you know, you could see them as a bridge, because, you know, it, within their lifetimes, they lived in two completely different realities, basically, and had to learn how to function in two realities and speak in two different, you know, universes, basically. And I had it much easier. And so, and yet I think someone in Willis's generation, as in mine, tends to internalize so much of what his parents' generation brought with them. And so in that sense can still be, I don't know if limited is the right word, but just shaped by a mentality or shaped by perception or internalized, you could say racism, but also just internalized stereotypes about what's possible for him, who he can be. And somehow within that progression, it takes another generation. It takes Phoebe's generation to really be free of that.
Sorry, we have a slight audio issue.
Should we do karaoke?
Don't tempt me. Actually, so a huge moment in the book also is when Old Asian Man sings Take Me Home Country Rose, dedicating it to Old Fong. And so when you come in June, you're going to be speaking with an English professor, Michelle Myers, and then we're planning on doing karaoke at Asian Arts Initiative down the street. So, yeah, get your playlist ready.
I'm scared. I'm excited.
Yeah. I mean, could you talk about that moment in the book?
Yeah, I mean, my parents, when they would get together with friends from Taiwan, fellow immigrants in their sort of cohort, their community, often the night would devolve into home karaoke with someone to roll out the machine. And as a little kid, you know, it just was like, oh God, here we go. And I think it made an impression on me. And one thing that definitely stuck with me was that they sang that song, Take Me Home Country Roads. And like, it was just always, it was a staple. And it wasn't until, you know, I was writing this book that it sort of, I thought about that a little bit, I guess. And, you know, I think in the book, it talks a little bit about why that is, but I, in reflecting on it, it sort of occurred to me that this song, you know, is so much about home, whatever that means, and that someone like Old Asian Man could carry so many ideas about what this country was going to be for him, what it could have been. You know, there could be hope, there could be pride, there could also be regrets all wrapped up in that. And there could be, of course, missing his home country, you know, his country of origin as well, and being in a place that is effectively his home, you know, that he's lived in for much longer than he was ever in his quote home country. So it's his new home. And yet to not ever fully feel like it has become his home, has fully accepted him, even though he's, you know, proud to be here. I think that tension or that sadness is part of all of that.
One of the things that I think, if I could describe the American dream, if I would have described it before reading this book, and actually other work of yours, I'm reading the collection of short stories, Sorry, Please, Thank You, which is just excellent. And the first story in that is about a person whose job it is to feel for other people. And so people will basically outsource their pain. And what I would not have put into my description of the American dream, or what it means to have opportunity, is a job. And I think that in that collection, in this book, people are working just jobs. And I wonder, how do you think about that as sort of inflecting someone's experience of, I don't know, the United States generally, or I don't know, maybe everywhere. Capitalism is everywhere. So yeah, how do you think about just having a job?
I like it. I like, I don't know. Pro jobs. I think that it's such a great question, and it's so complex, and I'll try not to drone on, but I'll read your eyes, and when they start to glaze over, I'll stop. But, you know, I wrote that story when I was a lawyer, you know, kind of early-ish. I ended up practicing law for over a decade, but I wrote that relatively early on. And I just remember thinking about how odd it is, this kind of existence of, you know, being paid, being very lucky to be paid relatively well, and yet I don't own my time. You know, I get to, I basically could pick up the phone and anyone on the other line, any partner at this firm that I worked for, could basically say, I now own your time for the next, you know, 48, 72 hours, because you are going to do this for me. And it got me thinking about, okay, I'm sitting here at this part of the spectrum, and it can get, you know, this is basically effectively the top of the heap, right? And, you know, and there's so many worse ways that you can be in that situation where you're not in control of your time, obviously. So, but work is always, I think, defined. To me, jobs are, especially in America, you know, sort of with the work ethic and in the culture of just, you're supposed to, you know, work is supposed to define you in some intrinsic way. It's supposed to basically be, I'll speak for myself, the bulk of your identity in a way, at least, you know, through your kind of young to middle adulthood, that's what you gear up for. And that's what you spend your time doing. And of course there's family and friends, but work is, you know, just quantity wise, right? It's probably the single most, and yet I also find myself in, when reading fiction, not having sometimes that texture so much of like, these people either are living lives of leisure, or this is all about everything but the thing that takes up the most of their waking hours. And to me, that I'd rather center it the other way of like, work can become both the kind of dominating subject and also a metaphor into so many other things. Speaking for myself, I spent a lot of time philosophizing about, you know, in a high rise building in the middle of the night, when you're alone, you tend to get pretty philosophical about what have I done with my life to find myself in this situation. And, you know, I've cried at work. I've made friends at work. You know, I think I've thrown up at work. I don't know. To me, it's just like a fundamental subject. And so now, even after I've become a quote full-time writer, I still draw upon a lot of my work experiences. And honestly, for my parents too, like, that as immigrants, they, or not just immigrants, but I mean, they, you know, growing up, it was such a huge part of, you know, it's like, what are you going to be? And by that, I mean, what is your profession going to be? And having financial security, always feeling like you're reaching for something, always feeling like it's not quite enough, or if we could just get over to the next, you know, hill, it's somehow that has just been such a pull or drive, maybe a push in my life that I still feel to this day. And even as I'm kind of like entering a different phase, I guess, as my kids get closer and closer to college, I'm just like, then I guess a little bit now I have some hindsight or some perspective to look back at that and realize how much it drove, you know, my entire adult existence so far.
Yeah, you just made me think. I mean, I come from people who work. I was in the military well before this. My mom was in the military. My grandma was in the military, and they always had jobs. And, you know, last year, you know, after a couple of weird job experiences, I took a break. And I eventually got to the point where I thought, okay, I'm not going to take a job until somebody, basically I started thinking, I'm selling my free time. Mm-hmm. What is my price? And money-wise, of course, but also culturally, what kind of place is this? Thank you, Free Library. I needed to take a break. My grandma would have, she would have made fun of me if I had told her, like, I'm going to stop working for a while. And even like, you know, I had some part-time stuff, but it's like go into debt to like get something that makes sense. And it's a lot of privilege that goes into that. But her generation never would have imagined quitting a job when you didn't have another job. That is silly to her. I had to discover the freedom for myself, but it also might be something that my generation, at least from my family, is uniquely qualified to sort of find and experience. I wonder too, so Interior Chinatown has been a great opportunity for the Free Library to get to know Philadelphia's Chinatown a bit better. Yeah. Philadelphia's Chinatown has been here since 1871. It has a long and storied history. One of the programs we're having is, you know, three generations of activists from Philadelphia's Chinatown talking about their work. And one of the things that I learned as a new Philadelphian was there's a group that started a charter school that teaches based on like folklore. It is in Chinatown, is for children raised in Chinatown. And I read about your parents. They started a school. Would you mind talking about that? I'll say this because in my experience as a Black man from the South, education was the thing that got you freedom. And so I just wonder how you think about that, how your parents might have thought about that, if you're up for it.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, my parents started a school called the South Bay Taiwanese American School. And it was very specialized in the sense that, you know, when most people talk about, say, Chinese school, it's to learn Mandarin or Cantonese, depending on. And my parents specifically spoke a language called Taiwanese. And there aren't schools for that. That's not, and because they had a kind of small sub-community community of people, U.S., specifically in a part of L.A., in the South Bay, they'd felt like in order to preserve the language, preserve culture to some extent of that they knew, they felt like it was important to, you know, educate their kids. And so basically just banded together with friends and hired a teacher and figured it out, you know, developed curriculum. And that was so much, I mean, it lasted for a while, lasted for several years. And it's sort of, you know, I mean, I guess it both was a success and also ultimately had a time limit on it, because as we aged out of it, there wasn't a replacement, you know, generation right away. And so, but still, I mean, the project itself was, I think, very much worthwhile. And it was, they, like so many, you know, I think immigrant populations just believed, yeah, education was everything, you know. I mean, I would say to a point of obsession that somehow it would answer, you know, it would solve all problems and it would open all doors. And of course it doesn't, but it was the bedrock of everything, you know, at least growing up for me and for so many of their peers.
And that kind of comes up in your book obliquely, because both of Willis's parents are university educated, and Willis's mom carries around her book of myths for a long time. And so could you talk about their experience? There's a passage, I don't have it, but it talks about how they went from, you know, a romantic story to, you know, an immigrant story to people just trying to get by. Could you talk about how you think about that progression in their relationship to maybe each other, but also maybe especially to the United States?
Sure. Yeah. I love that question. I think it is in some ways a kind of a lowering of expectations, or a coming to, you know, face to face with a hard reality, which is that opportunities for them, as you, this really ties to your last question, is as educated as they were, you know, these characters, they wouldn't be seen here as eligible for things that they would have been back in Taiwan. So young romantic couple with dreams of like building a life here and having a family and having kind of dreams of success kind of slowly gives way to, oh, we're outsiders, the feeling of, okay, then kind of taking on the identity of, okay, but we can be sort of striving immigrants and people will respect that. And we sort of learn the rules here. You know, we learn how to talk and we learn how to conduct ourselves and we do the right things, you know, act a certain way in the workplace, act a certain way in public, and present a very clean and sort of, I guess, acceptable image, you know, of as hardworking immigrants, and do the same, you know, teach their children to do the same. And that eventually sort of, you know, and that can last for a long time. It does for a long time. And then I think that gives way eventually to doing that and achieving a lot of their objectives. But at some point, the story doesn't seem to finish in the way, you know, it doesn't have a like a purely happy ending. It has a much more complex and ambiguous ending, which, or even not an ending at all, which is to kind of reach, you know, your senior years and have done so much, raised a family, had careers, and yet not, somehow not fully ever feeling comfortable at home, you know? And I think this is where the karaoke comes in. I think this is where it touches on real world events in some ways, you know, the rise of anti-Asians, you know, sentiment and incidents in the last few years, especially has kind of, I mean, it, not kind of, it has really, I mean, speaking personally, it has changed my own parents' view, like retrospectively, of their experience of the last 55 years here in the US, or almost 60 in my dad's case, which is really hard and sort of sad to think about, and yet maybe eye-opening and illuminating in that sense too, to just sort of realize maybe I've been, to some extent, maybe we haven't been seeing reality for what it was. That's mirrors, I think, the experience of the characters in the book, that they can have socioeconomic success, they can to some degree assimilate, and yet somehow you get to a certain point in that assimilation and you hit a wall and you say, why, you know, why don't I feel like, you know, yeah, why did I hit this wall?
Yeah, all of that made me think of the moment when Willis's dad catches Willis speaking in a put-on stereotypical accent and sort of cuts his eyes at him. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying makes me think, you know, maybe that moment made him go back and think, if you're going to do this, what did I go through all of that for? You know, right. I did that so you don't have to do this.
Right.
I wonder, actually, there's a lot that's really specific about this book. I mean, I read this book too and thought, I guess this is sympathy, thought about sort of analogous experiences for me. Like, I grew up listening to like rap music, and rappers from a certain generation were influenced by blaxploitation movies. And so there was The Pimp and, you know, all of that. Yeah, it was something I had to kind of push against as I was growing up. And given what's specific about the Asian American experience in this book, what does it mean to offer this book into mixed company? Are there things in this book that aren't for everybody? Are there things that, you know, you hope people get or whatever, but what does it mean to offer it into mixed company? And maybe what does it take to read this book well in mixed company?
Mm, I love the way you framed that. I think there is something for everybody, but I think there are people that will read it and have personal identification with it and people that won't. But I don't think that means there are there's less to be gained. I just think it's, you know, and what I guess to be more specific, the goal for me, I don't know if I had a goal. The goal was to write a book, but the project was to depict the inner life of this guy, Willis, and to explore that voice. And when you say mixed company, it's such a perfect phrase, because there's both this feeling of like, okay, for people that will know that identify as Willis does, or can recognize him on a personal way, I think there's a lot of like discomfort. There's a lot of discomfort in me, even honestly now, having talked about this book for more than three years, it still makes me feel a certain type of way, you know, of talking about this in public. It's like, and I don't know what it is. It's not shame. It's not pride. It's not, I guess discomfort is really what it comes down to. And then I have to question why am I uncomfortable? And I think it's because there was built in a sense of like, personally for me, of being invisible, of trying very hard not to be like, to blend in as much as possible, you know, not trying to be white exactly, but just saying, please don't look at me. Like, just let me get through school. Just let me get into your law firm. Just let me have a nice life and live here and be an American. And I won't talk about anything in a way that makes you uncomfortable, you know, and, or, you know, I no one ever said that to me, of course, but somehow I internalized a lot of this in terms of like, this is how we get by as, you know, immigrants, or as a child of immigrants, or as, you know, as Asian Americans, like this is one way, one strategy for survival. And so I think that there are probably parts, there are readers who say, yes, I somehow this resonates with me psychologically. And for everyone else, and that's most people, I think, to humanize Willis and the book is written in second person, to literally try to insert someone else's mind into Willis's mind and say, try this costume on and see what it's like to look through this guy's eyes. That was the other goal.
That makes me think again of that, I can't remember the title, but again of that first story in Sorry, Please, Thank You, because when the character is taking on someone else's pain, there's like a setting where you can see through their eyes at their uncle's funeral or something like that. It's a wonderful story, but I thought when I read that after reading Interior Chinatown, that I made that kind of connection to sort of being in someone's head, perceiving the world. You made me think, so another thing about blaxploitation films is in those movies, more often than not, they're kind of, you know, trying to survive, et cetera, but like fighting the man, capital M. And sometimes the man is like a literal character, sometimes like a cop, a politician, something like that, a white man. And this book has maybe two white characters. It's got the actress and it's got the director, I think, who doesn't have a name. And one thing I appreciate about this book is that you don't really need the man when it seems to me that you see these characters bumping up against walls that are put there by the structure. I wonder if, I guess, yeah, I'll just leave a question there is, how do you think about the structure of, say, white supremacy in this book?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think you've already partially answered it for me, which is very much appreciated. There isn't a literal man. I mean, there's a white woman, Sarah Green, and she faces her own, you know, sort of structural challenges. I think to have embodied the capital M man would have both limited, you know, the concept and limited the potential for the breadth of it. And I think, and also it, to me, it matches reality more. I mean, in terms of the structure is, it's not invisible. I mean, it has a shape, it has a name. It's this idea of this show that they're on where everybody has to literally just conform to certain roles that are set by the show. and you get these very reductive labels and or just sort of types, right? Even the leads are types, right? The hyper competent white female who, you know, is both, you know, beautiful and intelligent and seems to have no inner life other than being excellent at her job, you know, and the hyper sort of over-sexualized black male who's the kind of pinnacle of like heroism and strength and masculinity and isn't really permitted to have an inner life either, in that sense of like these are just types, right? And so even the leads are types, and then of course all of the Willis and all of his family are not even that fleshed out, right, in this structure. They're just reduced to like typecasting categories basically, and so that to me is the kind of construct is harder to get out of, because it is so sort of, it's just like it's the water that they're swimming in, right? You can't really escape the reality in which they exist until you can, you know, until you try to, but it's the matrix, I guess.
You can't hear me because I'm muting myself, but I'm doing a lot of intoning. I'm loving what you're saying. I'm going to ask one more question and we'll take questions from the audience. Just taking off of what you just said, Karen feels a little different because, you know, if the, you know, screenplay structure is super interesting and does a lot to push the story, it's also the moments where you slip out of it that tell a lot. So when Karen and Willis first get together and Karen's like, why are you talking like that? Mm-hmm. And she's kind of, she gets into prose much easier. And then also, you know, she becomes like a real estate agent. She gets out to the verbs. Maybe this is a question for all of us, but how does she do that? I mean, that really is, you know?
Yeah, she is, you know, Karen is a character who is biracial and so isn't as, I think, in the logic of this show, is like ethnically ambiguous. And with that freedom also comes a kind of like, with that comes a kind of freedom. I think there's also, Karen would say, other parts to it that maybe aren't so positive, right? The idea that you could be anything, that you're just a sort of a slate for people to project things onto her. But she gets to, because of that freedom, gets to, isn't quite as like constrained by the rules as Willis, constrained by the script, and gets to move around a bit more.
That's great. That's really helpful. Thank you. We are going to start taking questions. I trust you, there are people here and asking questions. I'm not going to try to turn this around. Charlie, I will repeat the questions for you.
Great.
So how did you, could you talk through your decision to use the screenplay structure as opposed to something more prosaic, I guess? And also I'll say, you'll have to wait until I turn them in, but in his other books, he also does that. Not necessarily a screenplay, but there's like a test. And could you talk about, using different forms?
Yeah. I mean, with a screenplay, there's just a lot less words. So it's way easier to write a certain number of pages per day or a 230-page book. And no, also, I look for the form that keeps me interested, because I also figure that's what's going to keep the reader interested. And I always look for the form, I don't always find it, but that feels like this either unlocks something that only this can do, or is like kind of inherent to the subject matter. And in this case, Willis, the idea of him pushing up against a fixed narrative that's being imposed on him, I could have done it with prose, but I'd be doing a lot of explaining. Whereas a screenplay itself, visually and formally, already builds in that kind of, you know, structure. And so I get to basically ride off of what is, I think, a recognizable form. Like, even if people haven't read a screenplay before, you know, you probably looked at a play in school, so you get the idea. I did a lot of work. And yeah, I've written, like you said, a set of physics problems, a test, FAQs, you know, advertising slogans. Like, I can't do anything straight because I get very bored of my own writing pretty quickly.
Just thinking about the hierarchy of characters in the screenplay, how have Black readers reacted to the way you've talked about the character in your book, but also the way, you've framed Blackness as Hollywood frames it?
I mean, I will say it's probably a pretty self-selecting sample. I've had I've had a number of Black readers who feel that it was illuminating for them, both for the Asian American experience and that the relationship, the dialogue between Miles Turner and Willis Wu was an interesting one, even if it someone more qualified than me could easily write many books on Black and Asian, sort of dynamics and create characters that I was afraid, honestly, that would take me down a rabbit hole, that would, the gravity of that could easily pull into a different book. So I did try to limit the amount of real estate that I gave to it, but it was an important part of it to me because for me anyway, Willis kind of growing up, I mean, I guess it's for me personally too. It's like growing up Asian, for a lot of kids, it's like, do I want to be white or do I want to be Black? Because there weren't models of coolness coolness, basically. Like, do I want, because that's what kids want to be, right? Or that's when I was a kid. And so you kind of have to choose in a way. Like, there aren't models in pop culture or in, entertainment generally, or, politics. Like, there are paths. And so that in that sense, it's not necessarily trying to comment on whether or not Black Americans face systemic bias or discrimination. Clearly they do, but it's more, I think, the perception, especially in Hollywood, that there are established models, and yet those can be just as limiting and constraining for the lucky people that get to be Black movie stars and TV stars and pop stars. The other part of it too is there's still a pretty big invisible group, in this novel, which is Black women. And so the novel also touches on that briefly, at least acknowledges that, while Turner gets to be this big star, his like female counterpart is, not there yet. She's not allowed to be the star yet. So yeah, I've had some really rewarding and like educational conversations with Black readers. I did a Zoom with a reading group that was, I think it was probably 25 or 30 Black women. And I learned a lot and had a very, sort of rewarding, enriching conversation with them, at least for me. I don't know about for them.
Thank you. I did get a question earlier by email. Somebody asked, and I think this is relevant also to you working on filming Interior Chinatown and also American Born Chinese, which is the title for like older high school readers. They present it as a binary, and I'm trying not to do that. They said, is it successful or is it just like racism reformed or something? I'm trying to think of something in between because, I think thinking structurally, we kind of have to, but do you see where that question's going? How do you sort of evaluate that?
Kind of grappling with it now. We're making the show. We're deep in it. We're filming and been watching with like, pride, I guess, or it's a weird word. I'm not proud of, but like just exhilaration and after, yeah, I think it's pride of watching some of these projects do so well. And yet there's a kind of anxiety for me of like, oh, well, I don't want to let everyone down by having, a non-successful one, And also like you're saying I think Terrence, the binary of it all is sort of like, I think we're just maybe exiting the stage of like, there are so few Asian American projects for so long that every single one had carried a lot of expectations and was a kind of exemplar. It had to be like the end all be all for a whole a whole decade, because you didn't know if you're going to get another shot for a while. And we all had to just jump on it and just rally around it. And now it's like, are we entering a phase, hopefully, where there's enough variety and quantity to say, is it a marker of success to say, we don't even have to think about this as an Asian American thing in that sense? Like, of course, you can see the cast, there's several Asian Americans there. But like, we don't look at every show and go, oh, there's a new white show out, like that would be bizarre. And we're way past that with lots of other communities, too. I think we're like, I want to watch that. That's kind of like, to me, that's the in-between of like, that's an interesting thing about characters, you know, that are having relationships and problems and living lives that I can, you know, that I want to watch and I can relate to.
How has your experience in Hollywood as a writer informed your writing?
It's made me a little less precious about writing, which can be a good thing for sure, but can also be a bad thing in that you develop, I kind of trains you a certain way to write in a very economical and kind of straightforward way, in a tangible way, and that can limit the kinds of things that you get interested in, want to follow, crazy things that are not filmable, you know, essentially. And so that's one way. And another way, it's made me really, I think I'm faster, and I think about things I can hear other people's voices in my head much more easily now because I've collaborated with so many other people and learned from them. Whereas for so many years, I was just sitting by myself. You know, I have my editor and my book agent, but very lonely, and I'm mostly just banging my head against the wall. So I do enjoy collaborating a lot and other people's creativity. And it is exciting. I mean, those projects are very, if I've heard part of that question, it's super exciting. And I do think something has changed, and it's really amazing. You know, I mean, I would say since Crazy Rich Asians, I was like pretty close to finishing Interior Chinatown when that came out. And that has been sort of weird because in some ways I was like, is this book even relevant anymore? I mean, not that this book is only about that aspect of the entertainment industry. It's not, but it has been weird to watch just the last few years as reality has sort of surpassed my expectations.
So the questions about making information, making talks like this, books available for the disabled, people who can't see, people who have just... So yes, we have audiobooks. There's a part of the library that specializes in books like this. And I believe they're going to get this book done in Braille. I can check on that though. We have audio also. You can get that from the website for sure. Charlie, thank you. Thank you so much for your time. This is a really great conversation.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.